Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, January 8, 2014. President Obama meeting today and tomorrow with critics of the NSA's Dragnet surveillance program. Will he propose any real reforms? Oh, I doubt it.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like
yeah, somebody's watching me, and I got no privacy. Thank you, Rockwell. President Obama, back from his vacation in Hawaii, is focusing on the NSA. And as I mentioned in the setup here, I'm dubious that he will propose any meaningful reforms. But there's always a part of me that has hope for change. And we'll see. He is meeting here on Wednesday with members of the task force, the hand-picked group of insiders that he put together a few months ago and said, give me a report. And they came up with 46 different recommendations, most of which do not get to the heart of the problem. And that, as I've pointed out, is that the NSA has drifted from its original mission to provide surveillance of people outside the United States and people who are real threats to our security. And by simply returning to that clear mission, we could clean up a lot of the problems with this rogue agency today. And as Cindy Cohn, the legal director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, pointed out in our recent Boiling Frogs interview, we need a constitutional-level fix because just reforming one program at the NSA doesn't do a thing about the FBI, about programs run by other intelligence agencies in the alphabet soup that most Americans can't even decipher. And to the president's credit, he's meeting with some of the critics like Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon, Mark Udall of Colorado, and James Sensenbrenner, the Republican who now has guilt, remorse over the Patriot Act that he claimed paternity of for so many years. He's even meeting with the president of the ACLU. So, I have no criticism of the president for hearing out his critics. I will reserve my blistering comments for when he actually outlines what changes he will propose. But in an interview with Philip Giraldi, an 18-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, the interview will be released tomorrow at BoilingFrogsPost.com under the Processing Distortion podcast series that I host there. And Phil Giraldi surprised me, because he thinks that there may be an appetite in the Congress to dismantle the FISA court, which is one of the fundamental changes that I think is necessary to end our addiction to secrecy and the whole specter of these secret and kangaroo-type courts. So I was glad to hear that from a man of his experience, and we will, of course, see how this plays out. The issue that I have, though, is that they may, for example, one of the proposals that came from this hand-picked presidential commission is that instead of having the NSA collect all our phone records, we will deputize the phone companies themselves to collect this information and make it available to the government on a specific legal demand, with a warrant, hopefully. I don't think that really changes the situation very much. The fact that they are collecting information on innocent people without probable cause is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's unambiguous. And for me, I simply don't want to compromise on that important constitutional value. So they're trying to round up votes, and in the Senate it's tough because so many Democrats are up for re-election this year. They're afraid of being painted as soft on terror or of abandoning the White House and the presumed support, including financial support, that comes from supporting Obama. So it will be tough to get the votes needed in the Senate. And it appears the only appeal that might work to Republicans is the economic impact on tech companies from Microsoft to Facebook to Google of being exposed as compliant or complicit with the U.S. government spying operations. We mentioned the other day that the Washington Post published a blockbuster investigative report on the money trail of the infamous Koch brothers. And it pointed out that $400 million was spent by a network of groups that is so labyrinthian and confusing that you must conclude that it was intended to do just that, to confuse people, to make it hard to trace where the money came from. Well, in our in-depth interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, we talk with Robert McGuire, who is an investigator at the Center for Responsive Politics. And here's an excerpt from that in-depth interview about the web of organizations set up by the Koch brothers.
We've uncovered a lot of different ways that these groups try to sort of cover their tracks. But what's so special about these groups is that they had a given name. And in some cases, this is how complicated it got. They had a name that they went by in public. Say, if you look on the chart, you can see Generation Opportunity. That's the organization that recently made the Uncle Sam commercials. So they've never reported any political spending, but you know, a lot of people have seen those ads that, you know, have a political nature. Its name is actually YEM Trust. When it files with the IRS, it files as YEM Trust, doing business as Generation Opportunity. Mm-hmm. But then, in addition to that, it has what's called a disregarded entity, which is a wholly owned subsidiary whose finances are completely subsumed by YEM Trust. And so what we found is that when Freedom Partners, for example, or TC4 Trust, which is another C4 that predated Freedom Partners, when they would grant money to Generation Opportunity, they wouldn't grant it to YEM Trust or Generation Opportunity. They would grant it to TRGN LLC, which has its own employee identification number. So there's no way you can look that up. That you, even if you have paid the thousands of dollars that the IRS charges for you to get their data, because there is no searchable database, you can't search that EIN or that name in their data and actually come up with the group that Freedom Partners was giving money to.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Robert McGuire of the Center for Responsive Politics. It's posted today at peterbcollins.com. And, of course, if you're one of our regular users, you know that you can hear our podcasts on the Stitcher platform. They feed smartphones and mobile phones. It's a great, great website. Also, on TuneIn, the TuneIn platform that is fed to websites and to internet radios of various types. And there are other ways, including iTunes, that you can get the Peter B. Collins podcast on a regular basis. And however you access our information, of course, the home base is right here at peterbcollins.com. I invite you to support our work here by subscribing. And people like Bill Goodacre, Andy Krieger, Bob Donjakour, and Don Cisney are regular monthly subscribers here. They kick in $5 each, and it's validation for me, and it helps pay the bills. So I would appreciate it if you would join that chorus of people who supports the work here. Just go to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, you follow the links that say sign up. And you can choose a $5 monthly subscription. If you've got the money and you want to give us more support, there are options there for $10 or $20 a month, and many people do take that choice, and I appreciate their generosity. The best deal is the $50 annual subscription, and we have renewed our bonus gift, the Kick-Ass Kona Coffee Bag. And there is a big package of coffee beans on its way from the Big Island to me right now from our friend Russ Archibald. And I'm grateful to Russ for renewing our stash of Kick-Ass Kona coffee. I also have a bonus book right now. It'll be Sibelle Edmonds' Classified Woman. I have just a few copies remaining. So sign up for a new subscription today, and I appreciate it very much. Now, whether or not you're a subscriber, the other way you can help us out is by taking out the free one-month trial subscription at audible.com. But you have to do it through the links either in the podcast file for this show or on my website through the banner ad that's on the left column. You click on that, you sign up for a one-month subscription, and you get a free audiobook download from audible.com for your trouble. They'll also kick in $15 to me for referring you for the trial subscription. So it's no cost to you, no risk. And many people have been making that little trip to audible.com and putting a few bucks into our coffers here. And I thank you all very much. Well, the debate continues in Washington about renewing long-term unemployment benefits. And I found this whole debate very interesting because, to me, it's a no-brainer. Unemployment insurance is a system where people, when they're working, pay into it, and when they're not working, they're entitled to withdraw from that fund. Now, to be fair, many of the state-level unemployment insurance funds are tapped out and have had to be replenished with federal dollars, and there are some bookkeeping issues there that I'll put aside for now. But I find it very interesting that Republicans want to hold out on a measly $6.5 billion. It's only a three-month extension. It affects about 1.3 million Americans. And the most insulting argument you hear is that, well, Rand Paul says, you know, after 26 weeks or so, you're coddling people, and they become dependent on unemployment. And there are people who game any system that you set up, like the cops in New York we'll get to in just a moment. But the idea that the average person who's out of work would rather get an unemployment check than get a job and go back to work full time, that's just a crock. And it shows how out of touch Republicans are. And so they try to equate unemployment insurance with some sort of a giveaway, a government giveaway program. And it's just wrong. Now, on the other side, we see the Democrats trying to make an economic case for spending $6.5 billion on unemployment insurance as a way of keeping the economy going. And I have to say, if we're that desperate, there are many other ways that we should be stimulating the economy, not just through unemployment benefits. We should start with defense spending cuts, reallocate that money to domestic programs. I want to give the White House credit because the Obama administration has launched a new initiative to fight poverty. They have designated five promise zones: San Antonio, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, southeastern Kentucky, and the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. Now, I don't object to any of those communities being included. But where the hell is Detroit on that list? I mean, Detroit is the city that is in the most financial trouble and has spiraled downward so far that if any city in America deserves federal support, it is Detroit. But the Motor City is not on the list. And this occurs, it's very interesting, on the 50th anniversary of LBJ's launch of the War on Poverty. And Rachel Maddow had some interesting archive footage from 1964 on her program last night. And LBJ's speech was actually, the main thrust of it was about cutting back our investment in uranium processing and the manufacturing of nuclear weapons. And the War on Poverty was kind of a second thought in the speech. And so I think this is too little. I think it is way late. This is the kind of program Obama should have championed in 2009, when the economy was clearly on the skids all over the place. But, like I said, I can't object to any effort to address poverty in this country. And what's fascinating is that Frank Luntz and the Republican spin doctors have decided that it's good for Republicans to talk about the poor these days. And I find it confusing and hypocritical because on the one hand, on this 50th anniversary of the launch of the War on Poverty, Republicans are saying big government programs don't work. This is another example. That's not true, of course, but they never let facts get in the way. So those who deplore big government and the war on poverty want to talk about, what, free market solutions to poverty? Just words from those Republicans. I want to give credit to Adam Liptak. He is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and in the January 5th Sunday edition of the paper, he wrote a very thoughtful piece based on another 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Gideon versus Wainwright. And that may be a decision you've never heard about. It set a standard for providing legal counsel to indigent defendants. Yes, the accused who don't have any money for a lawyer. And the Gideon decision set up the system of public defenders and ways to pay for it. But there simply isn't enough money, and the public defenders and other counsel are overworked. And as Liptak points out, he said that it's a complicated set of problems. He said that the Gideon decision created attorney-client relationships barely worthy of the name between lawyers with conflicting incentives and clients without choices. And there are now plans based on school voucher models in Texas and other places where the lack of legal support for the poor has been challenged. And in Comal County, Texas, they're giving out client choice vouchers, or Gideon vouchers, to the accused who can't afford a lawyer. That's a little bit of progress. Arnie Duncan is the Secretary of Education. Eric Holder is the Attorney General. And I'm surprised that they have released a report challenging zero tolerance policies in public schools. And today, the Obama administration issued guidelines that recommend that public school officials use law enforcement only as a last resort for disciplining students. And this is a response to a rise in zero-tolerance policies that have disproportionately increased the number of arrests, suspensions, and expulsions, primarily of minority students, even for minor and nonviolent offenses. And as you may know, I oppose zero-tolerance. I have zero-tolerance for zero-tolerance. Because it is a simply blind way of applying the law or any standards. Every case is different, and there should be some sort of mechanism to evaluate the issues of a case and not just say, you know, if it falls in this category, the punishment has to be this. So I give Duncan and Holder credit for calling out an important issue and hoping to avoid tagging more people, and it particularly affects low-performing students, those who are called special needs, those with disabilities. For example, students who are eligible for special education make up nearly a quarter of those who've been arrested at school, even though they're only 12% of the population. And this could be an easy way out for school officials who say, I don't want to bother with this guy who has a low IQ and who's constantly acting out in class. Who cares? Let's just call the cops. So, I am pleasantly surprised to see the Obama administration take that issue on. Now to the corrupt cops in New York City. 80 retired cops and firefighters have been charged in a suspected disability scam. Authorities say dozens of people falsely claim to have been traumatized by the 9/11 attacks on New York. A total of 106 people charged in the scheme, including four men who allegedly masterminded the scheme, directing hundreds of applicants to get Social Security disability insurance benefits of $30,000 to $50,000 a year. And it's really sad to see people, and, you know, I take cops as individuals. I don't lump them all into one group. There are bad cops. But in their ranks, there are a lot of good people who get tagged and tainted by the bad actions of others. And it's really tragic that the widows and survivors of the actual victims of 9/11 are still struggling to find the truth about what happened and who did it. And meanwhile, cops have been fleecing the system, using 9/11 as an excuse. My second shout out to Rachel Maddow in today's podcast, because she has been covering the story of the mysterious lane closures at the George Washington Bridge on the Fort Lee, New Jersey side of that bridge. They occurred back in September. And we're learning more and more about how high-ranking officials in the New Jersey administration of Governor Chris Christie used winks and nods and coded emails like, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee." That's an email from Bridget Ann Kelly, a deputy chief of staff in Christie's office, to one of the authorities, one of the executives at the Port Authority of New York. This was in retaliation because the new mayor of Fort Lee, a Democrat, refused to endorse Chris Christie for his reelection. And Christie is trying so hard. He had a couple of people resign. They're all trying to insulate him from this scandal. But it's getting closer and closer. And it shows just how petty the big man is. And I think this is the kind of thing that can do a lot of damage to a man with presidential aspirations, even if he loses a couple of 100 pounds. A couple of quickies from around the world. Palestinians Tuesday chased and grabbed more than a dozen Israeli settlers who had attacked Palestinian farmers near a West Bank village. As you probably know, these Israeli settlements are often planted smack in the middle of Palestinian communities. And the Israelis become very aggressive and arrogant, and either the settlers or soldiers aligned with them prevent the Palestinians from farming, from picking olives, things that they have been doing for centuries on their land. And so the story is that about 25 to 30 settlers who were wearing masks attacked farmers outside the town of Kusra in an olive grove with sticks and stones. A clash ensued. The farmers called for reinforcements, and about 100 Utes arrived from the village. The settlers ran away. The villagers chased them and grabbed them, and they locked them up in a building that's under construction there. Now, the Palestinians acknowledge that some of the Israelis were beaten, but only until they stopped and were detained. And then Israeli soldiers came, and this time it appears they defused the situation. Most often they take it out on the Palestinians, regardless of who started the problem. And in Turkey, problems continue with the Erdogan government. About 350 police officers in the Turkish capital of Ankara were removed from their posts overnight. There's been a corruption investigation run by the cops, and it appears the Erdogan government is doing their best to impede that investigation and stop it from bringing down the government. It came to light in December. The three ministers and a big cabinet shuffle. Three ministers resigned, and the shuffle has ensued, and Erdogan is struggling to hold on to power there. And finally today, I was hoping this week to bring you an in-depth interview podcast with a representative of the Beckett Fund. Never heard of them? I hadn't either. But they sent me an email last week taking credit for the last-minute legal maneuver that caused Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor to put a hold on part of Obamacare related to the challenges by Catholic institutions to the contraceptive requirements. And so I exchanged 17 emails with a PR guy named Mike Rudin at Shirley and Bannister Public Relations outside Washington, D.C. I asked to interview a representative of the Beckett Fund, so I could understand and also argue with their legal premise that somehow this is a violation of deep religious principles of the Catholic Church. And I would also criticize the Beckett Fund for cynically using the Little Sisters of the Poor as the entity being used to challenge a secular law based on alleged violation of religious beliefs. And fundamentally, the Obamacare requirement that insurance plans provide contraceptive coverage, which the Catholics misconstrue as also including abortion, that's flatly untrue. It would benefit the work of the Little Sisters of the Poor, who deal with the results of unwanted pregnancies on a regular basis. And, as you know, I find it flatly idiotic that the Catholic bishops of the United States, who can't get their followers, their faithful, to listen to their regulations — these are not moral decisions, these are church regulations regarding contraception. It is the most widely ignored standard of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States. And so the bishops, who can't get their followers to follow them on this, are asking the government to do it instead. And so those are the kinds of things I would raise if a representative of the Beckett Fund were made available to talk with me. But after those 17 emails, apparently Mike Rudin did a little research, maybe even listened to a recent podcast at peterbcollins.com. And in his final email, he got all tripped up over himself. And he was trying to say that, unfortunately, a member of the Beckett Fund would not be available. And so in his final email to me, Mike Rudin said, "Unfortunately, the Beckett Fund is available for this interview. Thanks for reaching out." Now, after 17 emails, I took this as a dismissal, as we're not interested in talking to you. But he couldn't even get his language straight. I think he meant to say, "Unfortunately, the Beckett Fund is unavailable for this interview." And, of course, we don't know who the Beckett Fund is, who runs it, who their representative is, how many people are involved. None of that has been shared with us. And in the 17 emails that went back and forth, Mike asked for my phone number. He asked how many listeners I have. He wanted to know where this would be heard. But all I can tell you is that the members of the Beckett Fund don't have the courage to confront somebody who doesn't agree with them. And apparently their PR team has instructions to only schedule interviews with people who are neutral or sympathetic to their arguments on behalf of the Little Sisters of the Poor. So I know you're disappointed, but apparently there will be no interview on the Peter B. Collins podcast with a representative of the Beckett Fund. But maybe I'll send them some contraceptives. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.